1330 WEBY, Northwest Florida's Talk Radio. This is Your Turn, a live call-in show featuring spirited discussion and debate about issues that matter to the community. Stay with us to hear what Northwest Florida thinks. Better yet, call in at 623-1330 and tell us what you think. It's your turn here on 1330 WEBY, Northwest Florida's Talk Radio. Now, here's the host of Your Turn.
Good afternoon and welcome to the second hour of today's edition of Your Turn. This hour is a special edition. We do this from time to time, our Middle East Roundtable discussions. I have with me in the studio Jerry Gordon, senior editor of the New English Review and its blog, The Iconoclast. Welcome, Jerry.
Good to be back, Mike.
And joining us from Washington, D.C., Shoshana Bryan. She's senior director of the Jewish Policy Center. Shoshana, welcome.
Nice to be here.
And through the magic of satellite telephone, Dan Diker, live from Jerusalem. Dan Diker's the executive producer of Voice of Israel and the host of National Security on the Voice of Israel Global Radio Network in Jerusalem. Dan, welcome to Your Turn.
Thanks. Nice to be here, Mike.
This evening, coming up actually in just under an hour, beginning at 6 p.m., will be a special presentation that Jerry Gordon is giving titled Israel is Facing a Perfect Storm. And this event's going to be held at the First Baptist Church of Baghdad in Baghdad, Florida, on Forsyth Street. Jerry, what is the gist of that presentation coming up at 6?
Well, Israel is clearly facing some major international difficulties. Off the top of the list is obviously contending with Iran's nuclear program, the negotiations on the part of Washington, plus a P5, plus one, and a new development, which is basically the Revolutionary Guard and its proxy Hezbollah right on Israel's frontier on the Golan. And then, of course, there's the controversy of something we call Bibigate. That's the controversy surrounding the forthcoming speech of Prime Minister Netanyahu on March the 3rd before a joint session of Congress.
All right, so Israel is facing threats from multiple sources.
Correct.
Multiple sides, and sadly, many of those threats are coming from the United States, which, as an American citizen, I'm not pleased to acknowledge. But, hey, the truth is the truth, so there we go with it. Jerry, I'll ask the first question with you. I think this is the overriding question about national security, frankly, not just for Israel, not just for the United States, but, in fact, for the entire planet, and that is the status of the Iranian nuclear weapons program. Does it really look like the Barack Obama administration is going to allow Iran to develop nuclear weapons down the road? I mean, did I read that right? That can't possibly be.
Well, it sure looks like that, except it's under the aegis of a so-called phase deal over a decade, in which it hopes to defer, essentially, the reality that perhaps Iran already has a nuclear device or is looking for a capability in that direction. And that is something that is really consternating. I know that there's been lots of commentary out of Israel objecting to what was announced as breaking news yesterday by the New York Times and this morning by the Wall Street Journal and other organs in this regard. So the question really is whether or not a deal has been struck with the Islamist regime in Tehran that would allow them to perhaps become a so-called nuclear breakout nation.
Shoshana, I've read reports that the Iranians are saying that the American administration is so desperate for a deal on the Iranian nuclear weapons program that they'll pretty much concede anything as long as they can hold up a piece of paper and say, peace in our time, they will agree to anything. Is that an accurate depiction of what's going on in these talks?
Why? Some of that is the general tendency of Iranians to overstate the obvious. Yes, the president is looking very, very hard for a deal, partly because he knows Israel doesn't want them, and at this point he feels backed into a corner. If it turns out Bibi's right, he doesn't look very good. So now he needs a deal. His thinking appears to be that 10 years from now, the mullahs will have fallen, the young Democrats will have taken over, and it'll be okay. The thing he missed, the big piece of this that he missed, is that the mullahs only represent one part of the Iranian body politic, and that's the religious part. Iran is also Persian, and even secular Persians are empire-oriented. So even if we get rid of the mullahs, even if we get rid of the religious basis for governance in Iran, and we have secular people in Persia want an empire. So if we push this, kick this can down the road 10 years and the mullahs are gone, Obama thinks that will be a good thing. I'm not sure that's true.
Now, the mad mullahs in Iran are somewhat suicidal and apocalyptic because they think that if they do this, it will bring about the 12th imam and some sort of everlasting peace under Islam. But the secular side of Iranian society, are they nearly as suicidal and crazy?
I don't think the mullahs are suicidal. I think the mullahs have pursued a very hard-headed, very correct from their point of view, approach to their own nuclear capabilities and the understanding of the United States. I don't think they're suicidal.
And what's your take on this, Dan?
Well, I would tend to agree that the mullahs are not suicidal. In fact, they're quite rational in many senses. And if you look at the way they've conducted these negotiations, and let's be very clear, the president of Iran is not conducting these negotiations. Ayatollah Khamenei is conducting these negotiations, and and his Supreme Council of advisors are the mullahs, and not to mention the IRGC and that ilk. But they've been handling these negotiations in an extremely sophisticated fashion. Let's remember, the Iranians introduced chess to the world. They're carpet weavers. They are extremely sophisticated at political warfare, and they have been doing a number on the United States in terms of political warfare that the former Soviet Union could have learned much from. And one has to be very, very clear, certainly from an Israeli point of view, that if this deal goes through, this is going to make the world, the free world especially, an impossible place to live in. I believe that the Iranian regime is dead set on acquiring nuclear weapons, and they're dead set on their promise to destroy Israel. They say it every day. They discuss it in Farsi several times a day. And I think that the Prime Minister Netanyahu, who is on a professional basis, a non-political and professional basis, one of the most skilled analysts in having followed the Iranian nuclear program for some 25 years, I think that the free world ought to listen to him lay out the case against this Iranian regime's race for nuclear supremacy and stop it in its tracks now and not when it's too late after they've decided to break out and acquire nuclear weapons, what they can do in a matter of months.
And I do want to get into Benjamin Netanyahu's address to Congress coming up. We'll do that later in the program. But specifically about these talks, the P-plus talks do not include Israel, and for obvious reasons. The Iranians wouldn't talk directly to the Israelis, so I get that. But shouldn't Israel be involved in the process since they face the most imminent threat from Tehran?
Well, clearly they should. In fact, they are behind the scenes. I think that it's very clear to people who are sitting on the inside that the Israelis have had a very substantial, played a behind-the-scenes role in these talks. It should be the P5. It should be the P5 plus two, and Germany being one and Israel being two. But for all kinds of reasons, Israel is not included in these negotiations. First and foremost, the United States would not want Israel involved in these negotiations because they simply wouldn't have passed the first stage because the Iranian regime's positions are completely untenable. The notion for your listeners, the notion that Iran would be able to enrich any centrifuges is completely unacceptable. The nuclear programs, civilian nuclear programs around the world, those that are, hosted by Canada and other Western countries, have nothing to do with centrifuges. They're just not part of the nuclear file of many countries that want to have peaceful civilian nuclear power. So the notion that the Iranians would claim that they need centrifuges to produce. Peaceful nuclear power is an absurdity. And the fact that the P5 plus 1 have allowed any uranium to be enriched is an extremely dangerous proposition. And that's the message that Prime Minister Netanyahu is going to bring to the American people and by extension to the world community.
And what about, though, the administration not even keeping the Israeli government apprised of the progress? I read in the Jerusalem Post last week, and confirmed in other sources too, that the administration is not telling the Israelis what's going on because they, one, don't trust them, and two, believe that Netanyahu is going to somehow undermine the talks through strategic leaks.
Well, and they They might be right. The administration is holding back because they want to present a full and complete deal. They figure that everybody will get all excited. We've removed the threat of nuclear war from the world, and everything is great, and I'm brilliant. That's the president. And at that point, Israel's sour grapes wouldn't have mattered. If Israel first came to the fore and said, the deal is done, but it's a bad deal, everybody would have said, too bad. We've saved the world from nuclear war. So the president was hoping to get all this done before it leaked. Didn't work out that way. I think in this day and age, you cannot assume that things will not leak. So bits and pieces of the deal have been leaking for a long time, and opposition has been growing, including in the U.S. Congress. Even the Washington Post thinks that the president is doing a bad thing with Iran. And for the Washington Post, which is a mouthpiece for the administration, to go that far is amazing. So now the administration is irritated. They're irritated with the Post. They're irritated with Senator Menendez of their own party. They're irritated with a lot of people. And the easiest person to take that out on is the representative of the state of Israel. And that's why they don't complain about the Post. They don't complain about Senator Menendez. They complain about Israel.
Dan, did you want to add to that?
Well, I think that Shoshana said it very well. I mean, I think that Israel's being, and its prime minister is being hung out to dry by this White House. I don't think we've ever seen anything like this in Israeli-American relations, where the survival of one of America's key allies is clearly at risk, and that the White House has expressed tremendous disappointment by the fact that the third most powerful official in the U.S. government, who is the Speaker of the House, John Boehner, invites the Prime Minister to lay out his expertise in front of the American people as an invitation of the direct representatives of the American people. And the White House, who did receive enough warning beforehand, simply is furious at that invitation, because they know that Prime Minister Netanyahu has the expertise and the experience and the know-how in order to make the opposite case. The White House does not want that case made to the American people, because they do not want the small print read that reflects the real dangers of this type of a compromise deal with the most dangerous regime in the world.
Shoshana, this deal is not being called a treaty. Does that mean that the United States Senate has no say in what happens with this agreement?
No, that's not true. There is something called the CASE Act, which was passed in 1972 after Congress found out, the Senate specifically found out, that the United States had concluded a series of letters pledging American help and support to various countries, including Vietnam, that that Congress didn't know about, including military support for Vietnam. So Senator CASE, then Republican of New Jersey, had passed a law in the Senate that said anything between the United States and other countries that looks like a treaty, that sounds like a treaty, even if it's not on paper, needs to be reported to the House and Senate Foreign Relations Committees by the Secretary of State. So existing in U.S. law is the CASE Act. Now, I will tell you, it's honored in the breach a lot. Lots of presidents have failed to give that information to Congress. But if I were starting in Congress right now, I would print the CASE Act in capital letters and send it to the White House.
So does that mean there would be a vote?
No, it doesn't mean there would be a vote. But it means that Congress would know before this thing goes into effect, because the timeline on when you have to come and report to the Senate and the House Foreign Relations Committees is very short. So at least they would have an opportunity to deal with it. What they did in the case of Vietnam, where they didn't pay attention to the CASE Act, where President Nixon didn't give them the secret letters that he wrote to the president of Vietnam, was in the intervening time, they passed the Church Act, which prohibited U.S. military aid to South Vietnam. So you had the president promising military aid to the South Vietnamese, and you had the Senate forbidding such aid. in order not to have that happen again. So we have two arms of the government doing two entirely opposite things. The CASE Act was designed to allow Congress an opportunity to make policy as well, to make laws as well.
But with no vote, I'm seeing that as informing Congress, but not asking for the consent of Congress, which means no matter how bad the deal is, hey guys, here's the horrible deal. You can't do anything about it, but at least I told you. Is that right?
Well, no, not exactly. You can pass other kinds of laws. Henry Kissinger tried to give the Russians huge amounts of money in loan guarantees in the early 70s, and he promised. And then they found out about it, and what they did was pass a law that said no loan guarantees beyond, you know, $2.50 will ever be given to anybody without congressional approval. Well, it killed the loan guarantees. You can kill things by going around them. You don't have to kill them directly.
The problem with that is
what the CASE Act would allow.
The problem with passing law is without two-thirds of both houses, President Obama simply vetoes it, and now it's not law.
Let's watch what happens to the Keystone Pipeline. Let's see if he vetoes it, and let's see what people do. There is huge support on the Hill for the Keystone Pipeline project. If they override the veto on this, I would think he's not invulnerable.
Interesting. All right. We've got to take our first break of this hour, and then we'll come back and we will continue this conversation with Jerry Gordon, Shoshana Bryan, and Dan Diker when Your Turn continues on 1330 WEBY.
Now, back to Your Turn on 1330 WEBY, Northwest Florida's Talk Radio. The phone lines are open, so call in and join the conversation at 623-1330.
Good afternoon. Welcome back to Your Turn. This is Mike Bates. With me in the studio, Jerry Gordon, senior editor of the New English Review and its blog, The Iconoclast. Joining us by telephone from Washington, D.C., Shoshana Bryan, senior director of the Jewish Policy Center. And Dan Diker joining us by telephone from Jerusalem. He's the executive producer of Voice of Israel and the host of National Security on the Voice of Israel Global Radio Network.
Dan, at the start of this program, I talked about some of the things I'm going to be presenting tonight. And one of them was on Prime Minister Netanyahu's recent statement about Iran opening up a third front. In January, we had an interesting event on the Golan in which senior commanders from Hezbollah and the Quds Force were killed, and there's been some threats about stuff, but there's also been some activity related to Hamas. What can you give us in the way of background about that?
Well, clearly, the Prime Minister and the Defense Minister have been speaking publicly about a new Iranian regime front opening on the Golan Heights. Let's be very clear. Iran is at war with Israel. Excuse me. Iran, the Iranian regime, is at war with Israel and has been since 1979. And most recently, this most recent episode of the Iranian regime's war against Israel has been this attempted front to open up on the Syrian side of the Golan Heights. As you know, Israel, according to foreign news reports, Israel struck a convoy killing a senior Iranian regime general and 12 Quds Force operatives in addition to Hezbollah. And the reports that we have on the Israeli side is that these operatives were planning a series of rocket attacks, bombings, anti-tank missile strikes, and other infiltrations against Israel, not dissimilar from what we saw in the south last summer by the Hamas terror organization, which have been working fairly closely in terms of training and tactics and strategies with the Hezbollah. And let's remember that the Hezbollah is not an independent Lebanese organization. They are an organization that are funded, directed, instructed, and approved, weaponized, supplied by the Iranian regime directly on the orders of Ayatollah Khamenei. And so this is a very dangerous development for Israel because it means that Iran's proxies are right on Israel's borders. Now, if you can imagine those proxies, Hezbollah, for example, has 100,000 rockets that are positioned against Israel. If they were a nuclear power, it would be a complete strategic game changer, not only for Israel but for the entire Middle East. So Israel's surrounded by Iranian proxies, even to its east in the Palestinian Authority, the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigade, the Islamic Jihad, Hamas in the south, and Hezbollah in the north. So you know that creates a major red line challenge for Israel to maintain security, its security red lines. It really should be conveyed to the audience here that Iran is at war with Israel, is surrounding Israel, and it will have to bear the consequences of Israeli defense operations in order to secure the one and small Jewish state that exists in the world.
Shoshana, what can you tell us more about something that occurred last summer after the war, and that was essentially a meeting between the Quds Force commander, General Soleimani, and Khalid Mashal?
Well, that's, as Dan was saying, Israel is surrounded by enemies, Hamas being one of those enemies. Hamas and Iran have an up-and-down relationship. Qatar was doing most of the funding of Hamas. It no longer is. The Egyptians are killing them on the border in the Sinai, and I mean that both literally and figuratively. They're taking away their smuggling tunnels. They're making it difficult to import weapons. And so Hamas needs Iran, and Iran loves the idea of Hamas coming back because that presents Israel with another problem on its southern border. And I would say that if you're looking at Hamas and Hezbollah in some ways at the moment is a little bit restrained, and I say that advisedly, and restrained is a relative term, and all relative terms are relative. But they've lost more than 1,000 fighters in Syria, which is a lot. And they have trouble in Lebanon with Sunnis coming over from Syria into Lebanon and fighting. Both of these things make it harder, though not impossible, to think that that Hezbollah would want to provoke Israel. Hamas, although it does have internal problems and it is fighting among itself, as it always does in fighting with other strains of Palestinians, the Iranians would be perfectly happy to go back to helping Hamas fight Israel if Hezbollah is finding it more difficult to be really overtly threatening at the moment.
Dan, you want to
The other thing that has to be added here, Jerry and Mike and Shoshana, is that Iran is making a play really to be the unquestioned hegemon and leader of the Arab Muslim world. Now, obviously, the ISIS, the Islamic State challenge to Iran, is substantial. And at the same time, there are many who believe that Iran actually established ISIS in the beginning of its barbaric and savage run through the Middle East. But at the same time, it serves Iran's interest for them as the radical Shiite power, major power in the Middle East, to back a radical Sunni organization, especially a Muslim Brotherhood organization like Hamas. Because the message that sends to the Arab Muslim street...
Dan, I hate to interrupt, but I have got to break for the news at the bottom of the hour. We'll be right back with more on 1330 WEBY.
Now, back to your turn on 1330 WEBY, Northwest Florida's talk radio. The phone lines are open, so call in and join the conversation at 623-1330.
Good afternoon. Welcome back to Your Turn. This is Mike Bates. I have with me in the studio Jerry Gordon, senior editor of the New English Review and its blog, The Iconoclast. You can find Jerry online at www.newenglishreview.org. Joining us by telephone from Washington, D.C., Shoshana Bryan, senior director of the Jewish Policy Center. You can find her online at www.jewishpolicycenter.org. And by telephone from Jerusalem, Dan Diker, executive producer of Voice of Israel and the host of National Security on the Voice of Israel Global Radio Network. You can find Dan online at www.voiceofisrael.com. Tonight, don't forget, there's an event at the First Baptist Church of Baghdad. In fact, it actually just began about 5 minutes ago. The reception, the presentation begins at 6, and it's real close to the radio station, so Jerry and I will be there shortly. But the title of tonight's presentation is Israel is Facing a Perfect Storm, and Jerry will be presenting the evidence of that, and then we'll have a discussion there as well. It's at the First Baptist Church of Baghdad on Forsyth Street, and the presentation will begin shortly after 6 o'clock, as soon as Jerry and I can get there and get set up. So, Dan, I interrupted you at the bottom of the hour news. You had said something, though, that kind of shocked me. You said that Iran might have established ISIS. Why would a Shia Iran want to establish a Sunni ISIS?
Well, a radical Shiite Iran that seeks to control Iraq in its totality, who needs a foil in the radical Sunni world in order to justify to a majority Shiite country like Iraq that Iran and Iranian proxy forces and militias and special security groups should be backed And therefore, Iran has done, the Iranian regime has done this before. They create, ostensibly, they create enemies in order to fight them. And then at the same time, the benefit of to the Iranian regime is that they can make the argument to the West that a stable Islamic Republic like Iran should be backed by the West in order to fight these so-called, you know, these savage barbarians in the Islamic State organization. And in all truth, the Islamic State organization controls large swaths of territory in Iraq and Syria. And clearly on the Iraqi scene, it's very logical from an Iranian regime point of view for them to have established ISIS and actually helped fund and arm them in order to fight them afterwards.
From an Iranian point of view, what you say makes sense. Why would the fighters of ISIS go along with it? Okay, we're going to be created by you, and then you're going to kill us. That doesn't make sense to me.
Well, they don't exactly tell them up front what they're going to do, because what they use is they use the Israel and the West card in order to create these sort of pyrotechnic alliances between themselves. Remember, in the 9/11 report, it was clearly stated and evidentiary that Iran and Al-Qaeda worked hand in hand, and Al-Qaeda was accepted. Al-Qaeda operatives fled to Iran and were accepted by the Iranian regime. So radical Sunni and radical Shiite organizations have worked together and do work together when it comes to common enemies. And at the same time, they kill each other by the thousands, which is another way of saying welcome to the Middle East.
There's a reason there's an Arab proverb that says the enemy of my enemy is my friend.
That's one way.
You're right.
No, it's not true, though. If you're outside for the United States, the enemy of my enemy can also be my enemy.
There you go.
He can be less my enemy today than he will be tomorrow. I mean, there's so many permutations. That's why it's an Arab proverb, because there are so many permutations.
Shoshana, there's also another wing of Iran's campaign that occurred recently. That was the pell-mell leave-taking of the U.S. Embassy in Sana'a, Yemen, by the Houthi insurgents, who are part of the Yazidi sect of Shia Islam. How does that put not only Saudi Arabia in jeopardy, but Israel in jeopardy?
Well, it does a lot of things, including have a major impact on the United States. People didn't pay a lot of attention to Yemen. It's a poor country. It's at the boot of Saudi Arabia. Nobody cares about it. But we had made major investments in Yemen so that we could plink off al-Qaeda leaders with our drones. But we failed to pay attention to the Houthis in New York, in the north, who were being supported by Iran. This is another, as Dan says, finding people to set up as enemies. So they supported the Houthis. The Houthis end up in power in Sana'a. And they are now about to sit on the bottom of the Red Sea, the exit from the Red Sea. It bothers Israel because the Red Sea is a major outlet for Israeli goods. It bothers Saudi Arabia because, aside from being Iranian-controlled, the Iranians export through the Red Sea. More important than either of those, however, is the U.S. problem. Directly opposite the edge of Saudi Arabia on the other side of the Red Sea is Djibouti, one of those places we don't talk about, because the United States has a major military installation in Djibouti to fight the war in Africa. It's the major base for Africa. So now you're fighting Iranian-supported Houthis across the Red Sea, or you have the potential for that. The U.S. is not prepared for that. The U.S. has paid very little attention to that. I suspect AFRICOM commanders have. But in terms of what the Houthi revolution in Yemen means to us, I don't think anybody's figured it out yet.
Dan, is there a strategic alliance between Egypt under President el-Sisi and Israel trying to combat some of these opponents like Hamas and ISIS, and has it been effective?
The answer is yes, Jerry. The relationship between President al-Sisi's Egypt and the State of Israel represents a serious upgrade in relations. I've actually heard it said by some friends on the Egyptian side that they consider Israel a strategic ally as opposed to just relations that are amenable one to the other. This is a major upgrade over the relationship between Mubarak or Sadat's Egypt and Israel, and it is clearly based on a very real and present shared threat, which is a combination of the Hamas as well as the radical Sunni organizations, ISIS elements in Sinai, as well as other affiliated cells in Sinai that are killing and attacking the Egyptian security forces by the scores, if not the hundreds in a couple of cases, and that there is close cooperation between Egypt and Israel. I know that there are great attempts to keep that quiet because the Egyptian street is restive. Egypt has gone through a major, or several, two major earthquakes politically in the last couple of years, and Al-Sisi is trying more than any of his, either of his predecessors, to read the Egyptian street and remain sensitive to the Egyptian street. It may be a good sign of a certain democratization that's taking place in Egypt as a function of major public outbursts over the land, you know, and coups, if you will, over the last couple of years. But as far as Israel and terror is concerned, there's a major upgrade in the relationship. There is a major shared directive to attack and neutralize Hamas as much as possible. And I will say that we're, for those people that believe that Israel, in maintaining its sea blockade against the Gaza Strip, let's remember that the Egyptians have completely closed the Rafah crossing. So there's only one possible entry and exit, and that's for goods and people. That's through Israel, because Egypt will have none of it and has closed completely their side of the border with Gaza.
Well, and I would ask you why Egypt is not condemned for not sending things into Gaza when Israel is condemned for sending things into Gaza, but that would be a rhetorical question. So I'll ask you a different one.
Well, no, you actually said it right. I don't know, Mike, if you meant to say Israel is condemned for sending things
into Gaza. No, I said it exactly as I meant to say it. That's
okay,
what I mean.
Right. That's the paradox.
Right.
We are condemned for supplying. You know, let's bear in mind, Israel supplies electricity to Gaza. Israel supplies water to Gaza. Israel supplies building materials to Gaza. Israel supplies food to Gaza. And, you know, and people wonder, you know, the fact that Gaza is controlled by a radical Muslim Brotherhood organization that is no different than ISIS in its ultimate goals. Its methods of execution are a little bit different, but its goals are the same. And yet Israel is still, for humanitarian purposes, supplying electricity to the people of Gaza so that they can survive every day against the radical Islamic regime that has imposed itself on the Gazan people.
And Israel continues to provide all of that even when suffering under daily rocket barrages from Gaza. It has completely defied logic, but the Israelis do it out of humanitarian purposes. And yes, I exactly meant to say they're condemned for it. It is completely illogical that the double standard against Israel in the world. I just don't understand.
There's even a triple standard. Many people don't know this. I'll reveal perhaps a well-kept secret. Israel allowed the wife and the granddaughter of Hamas President Ismail Haniyeh to come to Israel to be cared for in the hospital in Tel Aviv. Yes, you heard it correctly. Israel admitted the wife and the granddaughter of Hamas President Ismail Haniyeh, or I'm sorry, Prime Minister Ismail Haniyeh, as he was ordering the rocketing of kindergartens and synagogues and cities in Israel, we admitted them for humanitarian care in medical care in Israeli hospitals. I don't think there's a precedent for that in the world.
Well, that reminds me of a story. It's probably a decade old by now, of I believe her name was Amina Benwa. Am I right on that? The woman who was burned in the Gaza Strip while cooking. Apparently her pot blew up and burned her face and body. And she was treated for those burns in an Israeli hospital. And it saved her life. And then when she was returning to Israel through the checkpoint out of Gaza to seek further treatment at Israeli hospitals by Israeli Jewish physicians, she was stopped with a suicide vest tied to her body. And
yeah, that's correct.
And I'm pretty sure I was right on the name, Amina Benwa. And just the ungratefulness of the people of Gaza for what Israel inexplicably really does for them is just beyond me.
Dan, I would say that there is a precedent, and the precedent for this in Gaza is also Israel's precedent, where Israel is on the Golan Heights and taking Syrians who have been injured in a war that has nothing to do with Israel, and they bring them into Israel, and people, civilians, and I understand military people as well, show up on the border, and they are treated in Israel by Israeli doctors. So the only precedent that I can find for what Israel does in the Gaza Strip is the Israeli precedent on the Golan Heights.
A very good point to bring up, Shoshana. I read about that just the other day, that they are bringing injured Syrians across the border into Israel, and they are receiving as good a care as an Israeli citizen would. And when they're back to good health, okay, they're sent home at that point. But the medical treatment is given because the Israeli people, by and large, are a very, very decent people. But they're not portrayed that way in the press and by most politicians. And it's just, it's inexcusable that they are not accurately portrayed. We've got to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll continue. It'll be our final segment, and then Jerry and I got to get going to this event tonight, which I hope you can attend. It's going to be held at the First Baptist Church of Baghdad on Forsyth Street. Begins coming up here shortly at 6 o'clock. Title of the program is going to be Israel is Facing a Perfect Storm. Jerry will be presenting that, and then he and I will have a discussion after that, opened up, of course, to audience participation. So hopefully you can be there tonight. It will begin shortly after 6. We'll come back in 2.5 minutes with our final segment of Today's Your Turn here on 1330 WEBY.
Now, back to Your Turn on 1330 WEBY, Northwest Florida's Talk Radio. The phone lines are open, so call in and join the conversation at 623-1330.
Good afternoon. Welcome back to Your Turn. This is Mike Bates. With me in the studio, Jerry Gordon, senior editor of the New English Review and its blog, The Iconoclast. And you can find him online at www.newenglishreview.org. Joining us by telephone from Washington, D.C., Shoshana Bryan, senior director of the Jewish Policy Center. You can find Shoshana online at www.jewishpolicycenter.org. And joining us by telephone from Jerusalem, Dan Diker, the executive producer of Voice of Israel and the host of National Security on the Voice of Israel Global Radio Network. You can find Dan online at www.voiceofisrael.com. Dan, you are in Israel, so you've got your finger on the pulse, perhaps better than the rest of us. What are the opinions of the Israelis regarding Prime Minister Netanyahu's acceptance of the invitation from Speaker Boehner to address a joint session of Congress on March 3rd?
Well, I think overall, Israelis support the Prime Minister's receiving the invitation of Speaker Boehner to address a joint session of Congress. The Israeli public holds a rather negative view on President Barack Obama. He is not viewed as a president that would prevent Iran from acquiring nuclear weapons. He is not viewed as a president whose national security mandate would actually help Israel, and so the Israeli public have become quite suspicious of the president. Let's also bear in mind that the president's orders last year during the Gaza war prevented Hellfire missiles from being supplied to Israel in order to rearm the Israeli Defense Forces against the terror tunnels coming out of Hamas-controlled Gaza. So, you know, that was sort of a fairly unpleasant event, and the Israeli public holds this particular White House in a certain kind of suspiciously. And at the same time, when Netanyahu speaks to the Israeli public about the Iranian threat, that rings true for the Israeli public. They have experienced the direct results of Iranian-backed terrorism since 1979, frankly, or 1989 is really when the program started in full blast. Nonetheless, terrorism on the ground has been very clear in Iranian-backed terrorism for the Israeli public. So when Netanyahu talks about national security issues, and specifically isolates Iran, he wins on that issue. And I think that will go a long way towards perhaps Mr. Netanyahu's road to victory in the upcoming March 17th elections here in Israel.
Why is there such stern opposition by Barack Obama to this address to Congress?
Well, I think it's clear that there's only one person in the world that stands between, one serious person in the world that stands between President of the United States is, I believe, ill-conceived compromise deal with the Iranian regime and nuclear weapons, and that's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, who is probably the most skilled and experienced of any world leader on the Iranian file. He's He's a member. He knows his, he knows the facts. He knows the numbers, and he's a very cogent rhetorician, a great lecturer, and a great convincer. And I think that the president is very concerned that a prime minister with such expertise, who was invited to address Congress on this existential issue for Americans as well as the rest of the free world, will actually convince the Congress as well as the American public that they have to take a very, very tough line on this this what looks like an imminent, if not a very probable, compromise deal between between the Iranian regime and the P5 plus one. And so the president doesn't want the prime minister anywhere near Congress, but it doesn't look like that's going to be the outcome. Looks like the prime minister will address Congress and make the case for the free world against the nuclearizing Iran.
Shoshana, speaking about Bibi's speech before the Congress, we had two ranking Democratic senators who wanted to have a meeting with Bibi after his address. What does that sort of signify, and isn't there a message that the media is not conveying about who will show up to listen to him?
Oh, indeed. It's Senator Feinstein and Senator Durbin, two Democrats, senior Democrats, want to have a closed-door meeting with the prime minister. I think it reflects their concern that the American public has a concern. And here I would add to what Dan said. It's not just that Netanyahu speaks to the Israeli public. He speaks to the American public, and they trust him also as an expert, which, again, aggravates the president of the United States. Iran is named by people in poll after poll after poll in this country as the major threat to the United States, not Putin's Russia, not China, not it's Iran. And so given that, when the prime minister of Israel is coming here, Americans want their representatives and their senators to go listen. So Feinstein and Durbin are feeling the pressure of that. Other people are feeling the pressure of that. And I think you will find very, very few people who do not show up to the speech.
And so this invitation by Senators Dick Durbin and Dianne Feinstein, this is for a post-address, closed-door discussion that, from what I've read, is only going to be attended by Democrats. Are these Senators Durbin and Feinstein trying to politicize this to the one party's advantage when it's a joint bipartisan session of Congress?
Yes, they are, because they would like, they are feeling a secondary kind of pressure. First of all, there's the pressure from American public that believes that Prime Minister Netanyahu is the expert and needs to be heard. Following that, there is also a concern that Democrats in general are less pro-Israel than Republicans in general. And I say that in a very general way. It's not always true, but it certainly does look true in Washington these days. And Senator Durbin and Senator Feinstein want to be able to go to their constituents, specifically their Jewish constituents, and say, don't leave the Democratic Party. Don't leave us in the lurch. We're good friends of Israel. See, we brought the prime minister into a private meeting. We got him to tell us the secrets. And that's what they want. I don't know that it will work, by the way.
Shoshana,
the American public is not necessarily as uninformed as people tend to say it.
Shoshana, we've had two significant generals talk about the fact that the president's plan for a reauthorization of operations, I guess, that occurred under President Bush, lacks something. It's called a name. What is it, and why is it important?
And we've only got about 30 seconds for an answer.
Okay. The generals understand much more about the cultural reference points of our enemy than the president does. They've been there. They've fought those people. And the generals want the United States to have a frame of reference that takes into account the culturalism on the other side. And you can split that a lot of ways, but the White House is not very good at this.
Okay, very good. Jerry Gordon, Shoshana Bryan, Dan Diker, thank you for joining us. Jerry and I are going to head out to the First Baptist Church of Baghdad on Forsyth Street. We hope to see you there. The conversation will be Israel is facing a perfect storm. Jerry Gordon will be presenting that. Begins, about a minute and a half. it's right around the corner, fortunately, from the radio station, so we'll be there shortly, and it is open to the public, and we hope to see you there. So thanks again for joining us this afternoon here on 1330 WEBY, Northwest Florida's Talk Radio.